Aloha, this is Catherine Cruz. Thanks for joining us here on The Conversation, Hawaii Talks. It is Thursday, June 27th. The summer surge of COVID-19 that hit our islands first is moving across the U.S. continent. The latest numbers show the wave here could be peaking. We hear from infectious disease experts and the state epidemiologist. Water rights are still very much top of mind on Maui as that community struggles to recover from the deadly wildfires. We'll get the latest on a Hawaii Supreme Court ruling. And breaking bread, a way to get inside the head and heart of lawmakers. It's a different take on getting to know elected officials across the country at a time when polarization is high. We talk to the host of a national show, which will feature two of our local leaders and some of their favorite food. You're tuned to The Conversation on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Catherine Cruz. More than 2,000 delegates from across the Pacific have returned home after the conclusion of FESPAC 2024. Fears that the cultural festival would turn into a COVID super spreader event have subsided. While initially it was reported that no one sought emergency services due to COVID, we have learned that one participant did require hospitalization. That delegate was discharged this past weekend and returned to Guam on Monday. The latest Hawaii COVID numbers updated yesterday showed nearly 1,400 cases last week. We talked to Dr. Tim Brown, an expert in infectious disease modeling, about the latest variants, which may have originated in Asia and come here first before sweeping across the West Coast.
My best estimate is we're probably seeing introductions that came from Asia, Australia, New Zealand, because they actually saw the KP2, KP3 variants grow much more rapidly earlier than we did. So probably we got some of those new variants from them because we have a large tourist population, a lot of people coming and going. And, you know, we incubated it here, and now, you know, people who are coming here from the mainland are taking it back with them. And it has spread widely across the mainland. I mean, if you look at the latest CDC report, something like 71% is now KP2, KP3, or another one we've seen here called LB1. And these are the so-called flirt and fluke variants, which have 2 to 3 times as much growth advantage as the original JN1 did, the one that caused the last wave.
Yeah, and it seems to be that with the numbers that this is far more contagious.
Hard to say with the numbers because, you know, again, our cases are vastly underreported. People don't test anymore. If you do test at home, that doesn't get reported to the state in any way, so it doesn't show up in our active cases. It's only the cases that are done in healthcare facilities that really show up as active cases. So we don't have a clear picture from that. The wastewater is definitely showing us at very, very high levels. And certainly anecdotally, when I talk to people, just about everybody I talk to knows people who are currently infected with COVID or, you know, currently battling a COVID infection. So it is very, very widespread right now in the state.
You know, we were very concerned because the wave was happening right as we were preparing for all those delegates to come from across the Pacific. And the concern was obviously a lot of these island nations may not have the best health care, and would it be a super spreader event?
And that is a real concern. And, you know, I mean, I know the governor got Scott Miskovich down to the convention center to help out with testing, and Department of Health and others helped with getting masks to them. But my understanding is not a whole lot of people use them, unfortunately. People weren't really aware of the fact that we were in the middle of a pretty serious COVID spike. And so, you know, some of them probably have taken COVID back with them. And that is a concern. I haven't been able to get solid data on the current vaccination rates in Pacific nations. There's not a really good solid source of data on that I've been able to find. So we don't really know what the situation is back there. Hopefully it doesn't go too far.
What I was hearing, you know, were cases from a lot of these smaller island nations, you know, Kiribati, Norfolk, you know, Tokelau, those areas. And so we get a lot of it's just wait and see, I guess, to see if their numbers spike. But I don't even know if they're tracking it.
Yeah, that's the problem. I mean, nobody really tracks anymore. And, you know, I think the one factor that may play in their favor is Pacific nations tend to have fairly young populations. And young people are not affected as seriously as older people are. You know, for example, here, you know, the 6 people dying of COVID in the last week all were kapuna. You know, everybody from 60 up. In fact, 4 of them were 80 and above. So, you know, it really is the elderly populations that get affected most seriously by COVID from a serious public health perspective.
Yeah, and people should know that there are still people dying of COVID.
Oh, there are. We had a 2 or 3 week stretch where we didn't have anybody reported dying of COVID. But then this week, I guess we're playing catch up a little bit. We had 6 this week. And so, you know, the numbers go up and down depending on lags in reporting and other challenges. I'd say overall, the number of people dying of COVID is dropping, but there are still people, especially the elderly, who do die of COVID even today. So we're not out of the woods totally.
We are seeing our hospitals tighten up in the wards where they do have COVID cases, where they're requiring their healthcare workers to wear masks. You know, I think it's still generally highly recommended for visitors, but there is just this concern because we are seeing this uptick.
I've always been opposed to this lifting of mask requirements in healthcare settings because I think that healthcare settings attract the most vulnerable members of our population. They also attract people who are sick with COVID. And so allowing those people to come in and, you know, sit in waiting rooms, coughing away when nobody's wearing masks and so on is really just a way of spreading it. And I think, you know, a lot of the concern on the healthcare providers was that they're losing a lot of employees to COVID as well. So I think that's one reason why they want their employees masked. And yeah, what I saw, I looked at the Kaiser webpage a couple of days ago, and I noticed they were recommending it for people coming in, but they weren't mandating it. Personally, if it were up to me, I'd go back to mandating mask coverage in all healthcare settings because I think COVID is just too contagious, and it can still do serious harm to people, especially to the elderly, those who are immunocompromised, and there is still the problem of long COVID, which we can't ignore. And, you know, a recent estimate came out that said about 9% of Americans will suffer from long COVID. So, you know, I mean, it's a serious problem.
And we don't know enough about long COVID. And I worry when I hear, you know, my neighbors or family members say, oh, I've gotten COVID twice now or 3 times now. And then what does that do to a person's system?
Yeah, we don't know. I mean, you know, the problem with COVID is because the receptor that it uses to attach to cells, what's called ACE2, is spread throughout the body on virtually every type of cell in our body, it can affect almost any organ system. With COVID, we see not only the respiratory effects in the lungs, but we see issues with the neurological system, with the brain. We see issues with the cardiovascular system. It can cause some blood clotting and so on, which is why, at least for the initial year after a COVID infection, rates of cardiovascular illness, heart attacks, strokes, and so on are raised. That definitely persists for at least a year, and in some people it may persist even longer. And it may manifest 20 or 30 years from now with, you know, an early spate of heart attacks and strokes and so on that occur in people who had damage from many, many years ago. We did see that after the 1918 flu.
We're at a point where we've just come out of this pandemic and we're having to live with COVID. But, you know, we're looking over our shoulders because there's the avian influenza that's floating around out there, and we don't know what that's going to morph into.
2 thoughts on that. I mean, the first thought on COVID is living with COVID does not mean acting like it's not there. It means when it gets high in the community, take appropriate precautions and protect yourself and protect those in your family, especially those more vulnerable members of your family. And on avian influenza, we're repeating a lot of the same mistakes we made with COVID. We are not testing anywhere near enough. I think it was Michigan was reported yesterday to finally be trying to locate and test farm workers who are working with the infected cows. I mean, this should have been done almost immediately, you know, but instead we've run into roadblocks with the U.S. Department of Agriculture. We run into problems with the dairy farmers who don't want to test and so on because they're worried about what it will mean for business. And so we're basically flying blind when it comes to avian influenza. And with something that, you know, we know can jump species and that sometimes when it jumps species, it's very deadly, it's not something we should be fooling around with. So we need to be much more aggressive, I think, in terms of our federal response to at least doing surveillance and knowing what's going on with it. And right now, that's still comparatively weak. You know, we need to learn to live with infectious disease. It's going to be with us for the time being. COVID is not going away. You know, we're coming into year 5 now, and COVID is still going strong, as everybody knows. Like I say, everybody knows somebody who's got COVID right now. And it's going to continue to do that. We're going to see probably 3 to 4 waves per year here in Hawaii. And so, you know, we need to learn to live with that, which means taking precautions when it's necessary, you know, protecting those who are more seriously hurt by COVID, making sure we don't infect them. I mean, that's one thing. Second thing is there are going to be other infectious diseases coming along. You know, we have to worry about avian influenza now. But there are other things, especially as climate change is tending to alter where different species go and how they interact with humanity, we'll have much more chance for things to jump from animal species into humans and vice versa. And that's where COVID came from originally. That's where, you know, SARS came from originally. And so unless we're basically starting to prepare for that, doing much better surveillance on a global scale so that we catch these things early and don't let them turn into another pandemic, then we're just going to keep repeating this pattern that we've seen with COVID. And we definitely do not want to make that mistake again.
That was infectious disease expert Tim Brown, who we should note is retiring from his post at the East-West Center tomorrow. He has spent several decades studying HIV and COVID across the Pacific region. We wish him well.
HPR has won a first place Spot News Award from the Public Media Journalists Association.
Hurricane Dora missed the islands by hundreds of miles, but experts say that's still close enough for the storm system to pose serious risks of wildfires.
Listen to HPR's award-winning stories at hawaiipublicradio.org/awards.
Support for HPR comes from the Hawaiian Humane Society, dedicated to the humane treatment of all animals, accepting pet photos for its 2024 Pets in Paradise calendar contest through June 30th at hawaiianhumane.org.
We were able to catch up with Dr. Sarah Kemble, the state epidemiologist, yesterday afternoon to talk about the latest update on the COVID dashboard that details new cases, positivity rates, hospitalizations, and deaths. It also has links to info on wastewater studies across the country. Here's Kemble.
We've been in the red for our new respiratory disease indicator for COVID for the last couple of weeks. And this week, we're starting to maybe see a level off. So we're beginning to see the test positivity evening out. Same thing for emergency department visits and hospitalizations. Whereas on the mainland, as you noted, those trends seem to be going up right now. So it may be that they're at where we were a couple weeks ago, and we might be kind of peaking already.
And it yeah. sounds like we did dodge a bullet, you know, maybe with the FESPAC event. I understand now that there was, in fact, one patient that was hospitalized, but who has gone back home now. Anything you want to say about that?
Yeah, I mean, with us being in the red, I think that is what we should expect to see, is that means that infections are going around. And that's really what we want people to take away from the indicator, is that when you do see us red, that means there's COVID around you, and that can help guide the actions you take to protect yourself. When you are fortunate enough to catch that before you catch COVID, then go get your vaccine, because that's still the best protection against getting severe disease. If you are already in an outbreak scenario, then it's also wearing a mask. And those are things that you can choose to do at any time, really, to protect yourself. But when in the red, wearing a mask in crowded indoor spaces is going to offer protection that may be more important to you when you know there's a lot of COVID out there.
And then,
of course, staying home when you're sick.
And what can you tell us about the hospitalizations?
We are also seeing an increase in hospitalizations. We're sorry to hear of a FESPAC attendee being hospitalized. That is something that goes along with having higher case rates. We are at pretty high levels still of patients in the hospital with COVID. We aren't seeing a strain on census right now, which is fortunate just because other factors for census aren't as high. But the number of patients in-house with COVID is pretty high, the highest we've seen this year. That may be starting to come down now, but that is a consideration, that people do still end up in the hospital with COVID-19.
And then as I was looking at the COVID wastewater studies, you know, yes, our numbers are high, but we were also showing high number for influenza. And, you know, with all the concern and the headlines about avian flu on the mainland and the testing that's underway over there, what are our plans to test for avian influenza? Is there a test for that?
The good news is there are already a lot of surveillance pieces in place. Hawaii is, you know, watching the situation carefully of what's going on in the mainland with dairy cows. One fortunate thing for us, I guess, if you look at it from a disease standpoint, we don't have a lot of dairy herds here. We really just have one single active herd on the Big Island, and there isn't a movement of cows across state lines, not within the last several years. So that keeps us more at a distance from what's going on in the mainland right now. But we do have to remember that birds can also carry bird flu. That's why it's called bird flu. And we do have migratory birds that come through. So that's one thing that we'll continue to watch. Testing does take place for wild birds, so we do get some sense of whether we're seeing disease in wild birds. And yes, our state lab can test specifically for the bird flu.
And then what about in wastewater?
Wastewater is another interesting area. Wastewater scan has publicized the wastewater testing they're doing around the United States, and that includes the Sand Island site in Hawaii. We have had no detections here, so that fits with what we understand about the epidemiology right now of bird flu, but that does provide us another potential window on if anything were to change. But the other thing that people should know is we always look at flu in our general human population too. That's something we've done for many years, and we continue to do that. So we get tests sent into us from the clinical labs after people test positive for flu, and we do subtyping. That would allow us to pick up if we had a novel flu detection. So if we were to actually have a patient with bird flu, we would be able to pick that up through our surveillance system through the state laboratory.
Okay, and then is there any federal funding that is being made available for states to test for this new avian bird flu?
We've always had funding to conduct influenza surveillance for humans. So there's no new federal funding that's come out for bird flu for humans right now. But there are programs that are going on through USDA to help with the agricultural sector and testing in animals.
Anything else on that front? Just knowing maybe some of the missteps along the way as we were trying to deal with the COVID pandemic and what we need to do to stand up for any other infectious disease that's, you know, lurking around the corner.
Sure. With regard to bird flu, I would say the main message is still watchful awareness. The current risk profile for people is low, even in states where there are infected dairy cattle. There have been a few human infections detected. Thankfully, so far, those people have not been terribly sick. But there's a lot of monitoring going on. And it doesn't appear that the virus is jumping so easily from cows to people that we're seeing, you know, outbreaks in people right now. So it's a situation to monitor, but not a reason to be panicked.
Okay. And then anything that you want to leave our listeners with just in regard to COVID?
One thing I'd say, you know, as we talk about all these different diseases that are out there now, we're still seeing COVID. We have these concerns about bird flu now. We've got regular old flu that will come around again in the flu season. Just be aware that you don't always know what disease you have when you get sick with respiratory symptoms. So it is really important to both take precautions to make sure your health is taken care of and to protect others. So if you're feeling sick, if you have cold and flu symptoms, the first step is stay home if you're feeling sick. And if you're sick enough to need medical care, get medical care. And that can lead to testing and treatment if you need it. And take common sense measures. So when respiratory viruses are circulating, that's a good time to think about masking in crowded indoor spaces. Get up to date on your COVID and flu shots. Those are all great ways to stay healthy.
Okay. And then any other additional guidance on the vaccines?
We are hearing that ACIP is looking at the new formulation for the fall and going to be making recommendations on that. We do anticipate there will probably be a new formulation in the fall that will be updated to combat the latest COVID-19 variant. But even now, if you're not up to date with your 2023-24 shot, I would strongly recommend to go ahead and get it now and not wait for that new fall formulation. There will be opportunities to get that update later.
So if you got it in the fall, you might want to still think about maybe getting that booster?
If you're eligible to get us, if you've already gotten the 23-24 shot, which some people did about a year ago, there are some groups that are recommended to get an additional dose, and that would be for older individuals or if you have a condition that might cause immune compromise. So those folks should get an additional dose if they fall into those groups.
That was State Epidemiologist Dr. Sarah Kemble giving us some COVID context. She was talking to us about the summer surge of COVID and how officials are watching the development of avian influenza and its spread in the dairy industry.
Russia and North Korea have signed an agreement bringing them closer than they've been since the Cold War.
It echoes an agreement the North Koreans and the Soviet Union signed in 1961. What we really don't know is how much secret military cooperation there's going to be.
I'm Deborah Becker. What the deal means for the U.S. and the world. That's on the next On Point.
Beginning this afternoon at 2, following The Daily.
Each week, New Dimensions explores the social, political, scientific, environmental, and spiritual frontiers with some of today's foremost social innovators, thinkers, scientists, and creative artists.
Hi, I'm Claudia Lamoureux, founder of Mindful Digital Life and parenting coach. Next time on New Dimensions, I'll be talking about how to live well with technology.
Beginning Sunday morning at 11.
Continue the COVID thread on our show today, checking in with those on the front line. This week, Kaiser Permanente Hawaii began recommending visitors wear masks at all its facilities. It's requiring masks for staff because of the increased cases among patients and healthcare workers. We talked to Dr. Monica Nagyakwadi Singer this morning. She's a medical director and a pediatric infectious disease doctor, and who, as it turns out, just recovered from the virus.
COVID is now endemic, and it's part of our circulating respiratory viruses. Certainly, it's a little bit trickier because a lot of respiratory viruses have seasonality, and we know when to expect a pretty big surge, and we aren't there yet with COVID. So we, with like the great efforts of the Hawaii Department of Health and the CDC, are able to track, as you mentioned, wastewater data is one of kind of the first indicators that something is coming. And we could see that in May that we were seeing our wastewater viral activity increasing. And then from a hospital standpoint, once we start seeing the rise in people coming in for testing and medication and care, then we know something is, we know that the rates of transmission are up, and we're now starting to see the impacts of that on the healthcare side. So we really track a bunch of metrics to sort of figure out for the hospital what are the next best things to protect our community and our employees. And that's where we started tracking a little closer what's going on in the state. But then here at Kaiser, we're also tracking, along with the Healthcare Association of Hawaii, hospitalization data and also ER visits, urgent care visits, and we're looking at our test positivity. We're looking at who's in the hospital, who's in our ICUs, and then we're also looking at our employees and our people out with COVID, and we started seeing really large numbers of that too, which can impact staffing in the hospital, and we didn't want to get to a place where, you know, we weren't going to have enough people to take care of our patients. So we, following along with Queens and HPH, implemented our masking protocols for the hospital to help offset some of that and mitigate some of the risk for our folks here.
And then that's mandatory mask in certain areas of the hospital for healthcare workers?
So at Kaiser, we're having all staff employees mandatory masking in the hospital. And where we've posted signage starting this week to strongly encourage any visitors and patients to use masks when they come in. But yes, those high-risk areas like ICU, oncology, the neonatal ICU, those are places where we're requiring visitors to mask. We're not changing any of our visitation policies or anything at this time, but we're just making sure we're trying to mitigate some of that risk. given how high the transmission of COVID is out in the community. Overall, the ICU rates across the hospital, it's actually relatively lower in terms of COVID ICU hospitalizations. So there's about 16 patients hospitalized across the state in ICU. So we kind of use that, as you know, as an indicator of, is this a more severe strain of COVID? Is it causing more severe disease? And so far, we're not seeing that indication, although we are seeing hospitalizations up and visits to our urgent cares and ERs. It's quite commensurate with the rise in rates that we're seeing out in the community. So not necessarily more severe disease, because we can mitigate a lot of the more severe and damaging outcomes of COVID, because we do have Paxlovid, we do have vaccines that are available. So we're hopeful that these things are going to help prevent a lot of that hospitalization and ICU admissions.
And then I don't know if you're seeing any uptick with patients that might have long COVID, because we still don't know a lot about that area.
We don't. On the pediatric side, I know I'm infectious diseases, but I'm often taking care of them in the acute phase if kids are being hospitalized, and I'm not seeing a lot more of the long COVID or long-term effects, but that's not to say that it's not happening. I'm just not in that space. So I would defer to the folks that are actually tracking that and monitoring that. They would probably be more informed about what's going on out there.
Is there anything else you can share with us just about maybe some of the other respiratory diseases? Because, you know, we were hearing a lot about RSV earlier, in infants, right, in mm-hmm. small children, and then just general flu.
Yeah, so I think that it's quite timely because, again, we have mitigation measures for RSV and flu. Now we have vaccination for RSV, and, you know, we're trying to vaccinate pregnant moms to prevent severe outcomes in their infants when they're exposed to RSV. And we have year-round circulation of RSV or RSV here in Hawaii. So we implement those mitigation measures year-round here. And I would say right now our RSV levels that are circulating, it's still out there, but we're not seeing a ton of hospitalizations from RSV specifically in our infants. But there are still a lot of other viruses. We have enterovirus, rhinovirus, hospitalizations, human metapneumovirus. So they come in kind of these waves, and often children that are really young or have any underlying conditions that may predispose them to have a more severe illness like asthma, those kids end up hospitalized with these infections. So I would just say, in terms of, a lot of us feel like, oh, I have a stuffy nose and maybe a little bit of a cough, it's probably just a summer virus. You may be right, but it's also a good idea to just go ahead and test for COVID. If you're not feeling well, maybe don't go to summer school that day or the indoor activity that you were planning on doing. You might want to stay home and not just test once for COVID, but I would say test a couple of times, maybe a day or two after your symptom onset, because I would say that test can sometimes be negative right up front and then eventually become positive as you have more viral replication. But right now, again, we watch our flu surveillance, but I haven't seen a big uptick in our flu hospitalizations or flu positive cases in the last couple of weeks.
Getting back to COVID, you know, the numbers I know are probably a little squishy just because people are either not testing
Right.
They're testing and they're not reporting it to their doctor
family got COVID like 3 weeks ago. And aside from telling everyone at work, I have COVID, I'm going to be working from home and doing telehealth. I wasn't reporting it into a system. So that is such a great point. And when you look at the dashboards posted by the state health department, they're giving us our 7-day test positivity, which is, you know, almost 18% this week when it's updated every Wednesday. That's just tests that are done in a clinical lab at your primary care office, at urgent care. So this doesn't account for a large amount of people who are testing at home and not reporting it into anywhere, but perhaps staying home and isolating. But that's a huge caveat, right?
So yes.
We're looking at these numbers, knowing that there is a little bit of a um, there's there's a missing chunk of data there.
It's probably a safe bet to say that it's much higher than what is being reported.
Correct.
The other thing, too, is I know Kaiser, I believe, is one of the few places that is offering the free tests because the government ended a lot of those programs. But you can still purchase the tests at places as well for those who are not Kaiser members.
Yeah, we check with your health insurance to see if they would still cover the test kit, because I was HMSA before Kaiser, and you could submit your receipts. It's not the easiest process. They don't make it super easy, but it's still an option because the test can be quite costly. So that's an option. You can always also phone your provider and get a test in the office if you need to as well.
Okay. And then any final thoughts?
I think it's great that you are covering this and we're talking about it. We don't want to incite panic or fear in folks because we've been here before. We know how to handle an uptick in COVID and we know which mitigation measures work. I think we live in a really special community. I've been going to the grocery store. If I go to the gym, I see folks in masks. So people are taking appropriate precautions, especially if you are a high-risk person. You really want to think about how can I protect myself when I go out there. Again, not in a place of, we're back to the dark ages of the beginning of the pandemic, but we are in a different place where we can protect ourselves and we have good medicines and good vaccines. And as you know, an updated vaccine for COVID will probably be coming out this fall. So just like flu, where we monitor what strains are circulating out there, we do the same with COVID. And I suspect we're going to have vaccines that are formulated to align with which strains are circulating out there. And maybe we can offset some of these surges that we're all experiencing. Because I know personally, I got my vaccine booster back in October. And so when I got COVID this time, I didn't feel really great, but I also, there is some evidence that that vaccine, the last strain of vaccine, still is effective at preventing hospitalization and really severe illness in folks. So get your immunization and stay safe.
That was Kaiser Permanente Hawaii's infectious disease doctor, Monica Nayakwadi Singer, who we talked to this morning about how it is handling the increased COVID positivity that is circulating through the community.
Spanish soccer fans are pumped because the next big superstar could be one of their own, and he is only 16. His name, Lamine Yamal.
Desparpajo, ¿no? Tiene esas cualidades innatas.
This fan says Yamal's got nerve and self-confidence. He could be the next Lionel Messi. Soccer gets a new phenom. That's next time on The World.
Beginning this afternoon at 1.
Hollywood last summer was at something of a strike-induced standstill, which has meant fewer blockbusters this year, but there are signs of hope.
You know, it's just not Barbenheimer-level awareness right now, but the world of good movie-making is still alive and well.
I'm Kai Rizdahl, the long tail of a couple of long strikes. Next time on Marketplace.
Beginning this evening at 6.
Today we take a closer look at a recent ruling by the Hawaii Supreme Court over a water rights case on Maui. Here to talk about it is HPR reporter Kuʻuvehi Hiraishi. Good morning, Kuʻuvehi.
Good morning, Catherine. Yes, a more than 2-decade-long court battle over water in central Maui has come to an end with the state Supreme Court ruling last Thursday that the State Water Commission failed to be proactive in restoring stream flow in a region of central Maui known as Nawai'eha. Kaulana Nawai'eha, famous are the four great waters, Wai'ehu, Wai'he'e, Wai'luku, and Wai'kapu. Nawai'eha was once the largest continuous region of wetland coral cultivation in the island until, of course, the sugar plantation comes to town and streams begin to be diverted for a good 150 years. And then so the background for this case, of course, comes in 2016 when Hawaiian Commercial and Sugar Company, or HCNS, closes up shop. So the plantation technically does not need that water anymore. But instead of demanding that water be restored to the streams, the commission sort of continues this process to allow private water users to continue to divert water. This 134-page ruling, very fun to read, written by Justice Sabrina McKenna, says, you know, rather than proactively addressing the historic opportunity to restore stream flow, she writes, the commission's decision appears to be the result of a passive failure to take initiative to protect the public trust. Earth Justice Attorney Isaac Moriwake, who represented community groups Hui'una Wai'eha and Maui Tomorrow in this case, praised the High Court for their work.
This is a legacy issue. We're making these decisions for generations to come, seven generations, some would say, right? And Nawai'eha, they're the legendary four waters of Maui. Nawai'ekaulana, the famous waters. And this is our opportunity to really live up to our legal obligation, our trust obligation, to restore those rivers and streams worthy of their name.
So the ruling does send the issue back to the Water Commission to work out. Moriwake says this latest ruling follows a long line of cases where you find the courts intervening in situations to keep the Water Commission accountable to its public trust duties. And over the years, communities have been fighting the commission for stream restoration, but this criticism of the Water Commission not being proactive in their public trust duties is actually lessened over time, according to Moriwake.
As a historical trend, the Water Commission has gotten a lot more proactive. And credit has to go to some real leaders on the Water Commission staff and even the commissioners as well, taking seriously their legal kuleana, their public trust kuleana, to protect the water resources, to protect community rights to water. And so, you know, now we're seeing the Water Commission for the first time in its decades-long history restoring stream flows like to the West Maui streams and that Lahaina region.
Yeah, it's really interesting to see what's going to happen next.
Right, then this is coming, of course, this case ruling is coming as the Water Commission itself is trying to fill a vacancy. This is a commission seat specifically set aside for an expert, sort of cultural practitioner, Native Hawaiian practitioner who has that cultural knowledge, but also that pilina or connection to our Wai resources. The four names on the short list for that seat, Makahiapo Cashman, director of the Lo'i Up at Kanewai at UH Manoa, Auntie Laurie Buchanan, a chair of the Molokai Planning Commission, and Hannah K. Springer, a name I haven't heard in a long time, for former OHA trustee from Ka'upulehu there on the Big Island, and Kimo Falconer, a former agricultural director for the Old Pioneer Mill. The final decision is up to Governor Josh Green, but we are expecting that announcement sort of any day now.
And do you know when the commission is next scheduled to meet?
It's the third Mondays, I believe, of every month, so not till next month. But we did see sort of the departing words from outgoing Commissioner Neil Hannes, whose seat they're trying to fill earlier this month. Shoes to fill, so to speak, on this seat.
And then I'm trying to remember. I know there was a flap over the director of Manuel, right, Khalil Manuel. Where are we at with that?
Right. Yeah. Well, they've filled deputy position is now filled by Ryan Kanaka Ole, who came over from the Attorney General's office. So that position is filled. Interesting to see who takes up this next position on the commission itself to kind of direct the work of a director and deputy.
Yeah, but certainly water rights are a big issue for Maui. So it'll be interesting to see what happens next. But thank you so much, Kuvehi.
Mahalo.
That was HPR's Kuvehi Reishi with an update on the water struggles there on Maui. Look for her stories on hawaiipublicradio.org. You know, many people will be tuning into the presidential debate on CNN later today. HPR will be carrying the program. And this morning, we look at a different approach to political discourse in this country. You may know Alexander Heffner as a host of the PBS program Open Mind. He also hosts a show on Bloomberg TV called Breaking Bread with Alexander. The series features Heffner chowing down with several state governors and U.S. congressmen and women on some of their favorite foods. The second season of the show kicks off a week from today on the 4th of July holiday and will feature Hawaii Senator Mazie Hirono and Governor Josh Green. Episodes were filmed this past fall. We talked with Heffner about the idea for this show that was born out of the pandemic.
I was searching for what was really motivating me. And believing that politics were kind of in a warped, dysfunctional place, and there was an opportunity to inject enthusiasm for humanity in political discourse. And I had just gotten through watching a series of food programs, and ever since being a student, I'd watch C-SPAN and the Sunday morning talk shows, Meet the Press, Face the Nation. And I said to myself, there was not really something that infused the spirit of humanity, and specifically fun and our culinary life and the sense of adventure with politics and political issues. And I have found over the course of my life, you know, that the more you get to the source of learning about people's aspirations and resentments in life and what the causal effect might have been, you know, correlation between their convictions and how they arrived at them, it seemed to me you really have to go out into the field and into the geography of this country. So the original genesis was this idea that no one had done a program having meals with electeds, and I specifically identified governors and senators that seemed to be the relevant parties here. And then, you know, hoping that the net result would be inspiring a new generation of leadership over meals, and in this second season, more than just meals, activities too, whether that's a beachside walk with Governor Green or doing a gardening and a groundbreaking with Senator Hirono. You know, I think the activities, even maybe more so than the meals, are enduring in what they have to offer people. So at the end of the day, politics can be not just about exploiting constituencies to get elected, but it can be about our fundamental values in humanity, and that's what we try to illuminate.
Well, here in Hawaii, you know, one of the values that we hold dear is the sense of place. And so, you know, the fact that you came over here and got our lawmakers, you know, here at home doing what they do is nice.
Thank you. Thank you. Well, it was a special opportunity. I joked with both the governor and senator, you know, that I had contemplated transferring to the University of Hawaii on many occasions from an ivory tower in the Northeast. And, you know, you hear about these family vacations to Hawaii. I had felt somewhat deprived and diminished, uncultured as a result of never having stepped foot until those interviews. And it was an eye-opening experience from, you know, the natural perspective, the natural beauty being one of a kind. And the culinary experience and, you know, all the indigenous and imported elements of the state, you know, and of course the history of Pearl Harbor. It was, being a historian, you know, a really unique experience to be there. And I think, you know, the hospitality that both the governor and senator extended me was really special.
You know, were were able to spend time with Governor Green, you know, who was a doctor, you know, our first doctor governor. He had an experience in rural Hawaii, you know, coming from the mainland, and, you know, has just a different perspective. And then with Senator Hirono and her background as well, we've had other trailblazers, you know, in Congress, you know, Patsy Mink as well. But yeah, it's a really rich history, and the diversity, I think, here in Hawaii is our strength.
Yeah, it was a really exceptional quality, and, you know, also something that I related to as someone who grew up in New York and still is. If I am most native of any one land, it would be New York, even though I've spent time in other parts of the country. But Honolulu was just unbelievable. I mean, the way the nexus of cosmopolitan life and nature and a melting pot of an island, I mean, Honolulu, and, you know, was truly mesmerizing to me, whether it was the culinary scene or the kinds of interactions I was having with people, you know, across, you know, different strata of society. It was as much a melting pot as New York. And I think that the interviews with the governor and the senator, and each of them has had their own struggle to assimilate in a sense, but each has found ways to persevere. And I think that was the interesting juxtaposition of the two episodes. And, you know, we're thrilled that with second season of the program, we'll have a doctor, a veterinarian, a reverend, a Navy pilot, a basketball player, and the first and only now incumbent immigrant senator in the United States Senate. And again, each of them has been tested in profound ways over the span of decades or just in the span of the last 2 years. And, you know, I'm happy to chat more with you about the substance of that in any ways that you're interested.
Well, I do have to say, though, you know, while we're all about a sense of place, we're all about a sense of food. So I'm just curious what you broke bread over.
Yeah, for sure. Well, the poke with Governor Green was excellent. And there was also some shellfish and pork belly. And I got to have the pig and the lady. Yes. It was a recommendation of a friend, and that was a restaurant you have to go to if you're going to Honolulu. And with Senator Hirono, it was classic Japanese fare, traditional Japanese tonkatsu. She really enjoyed being at the place that she first went to when she was a young woman or even a little girl, because it was a restaurant near her neighborhood and school. And then she took me for a tour of her high school alma mater, and that was a really great experience to see her interact with the current students and share in that, and also meet with some of the newspaper and yearbook staff. You know, the light she brings to them on the national stage, she's often identified through ideology or kind of strong-willed combative politics, but in person, you know, you just see the inner light shine of a person who may be tough on any issue in pushing for legislation that's going to better her community, but there is a humanity. And she tells a story about how she found a way to work with Senator Sessions, and he clearly, you know, agreed to a compromise, and I think he was the presiding chair at the time, but there was something that in her moral fiber and being that resonated with him. And I think if you watch her episode with an open mind, you'll see a person different from kind of the portrait that you may hear on the national stage and maybe even in the state.
Well, you know, you approach, I guess, these newsmakers, I guess, with an open mind. But I'm just curious, like, your takeaway in a time when we are so polarized in our communities, you know, locally and nationally. What was your takeaway?
My takeaway was that the infrastructure of politics is, it's a corrupting force, is leading us to believe that we are unable to kind of do basic and imaginative things. And to spell that out a little more deeply, I mean, the nature of political discourse is driven by a two-party system, often called kind of monopolistic, cannibalistic, duopolistic, right? But politics, when it works, is about people and the expressions of humanity across these meals and activities we were engaged in. I mean, is, I think, the secret sauce to infuse and animate a renaissance, a revival of, you know, decency and dialogue. They're kind of three D's, as I think of it. Decency, dialogue, deliberation. That's the essence of democracy, right? If you can't hold on to those things, you risk losing your democratic process. So the big takeaway was just these electeds are people who, most of them, if not all 20 plus, but I think I can speak safely about Governor Green and Senator Hirono, would wave a magic wand if there could be some instrument for consensus and bridge building.
That was Alexander Heffner, host of the Bloomberg TV show Breaking Bread with Alexander and Open Mind on PBS. Season 2 of the series will premiere next week, Thursday, on the 4th of July holiday. The series is to feature Hawaii's Mazie Hirono, the country's first Asian woman in the U.S. Senate, as well as Governor Josh Green.
Something keeps him going miles and miles a day to find another place.
Well, that does it for us today. Up tomorrow, what's with all these arrests of state sheriffs this week? We plan to hear from the division director. Give us some feedback. Call our talkback line, 808-792-8217, or email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. You can find The Conversation as a podcast on Spotify, Apple, or Google, or on our website. I'm Catherine Cruz. Join us tomorrow for more of The Conversation.